It was brutal, still brutal, but we've been fighting through it and working at keeping ourselves alive and trying to find out what the real truth of all this is.
Nearly 34 years after the Lockerbie bombing, victims' families are still seeking justice. It's Monday, December 12th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, we look back on Apollo 17, 50 years later, and ask why public interest in missions to the moon has waned. And we get up to speed on the cheating scandal rocking professional chess. But first, the U.S. has custody of a former Libyan intelligence officer who they say made the bomb that brought down Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland in 1988. Abu Aguila Mohammed Massoud Kir al-Marimi made his first court appearance in D.C. today, 2 years after American authorities unsealed criminal charges against him, and decades after two other Libyan men were charged in connection with the bombing. The attack killed 270 people, including a group of Syracuse University students traveling home for the holidays. One of them was Richard Minetti, whose father Robert spoke with Robin Young this morning about the news.
It was kind of a shock yesterday.
Yeah. Remind us why.
Well, it's been something we have been pestering the government about for 30-some years. Most recently, my daughter Kara Weeps, Stephanie Bernstein, and Bryce Daniels have been going to Washington like every 6 weeks for the last 3 years, just trying to keep this thing on track, despite all the stuff that's been going on in Washington. So it was really nice to have this actually happen.
Yeah. Well, you know, it is resounding for so many people. It's resounding in Scotland. The field there where this crash took place is sacred ground. By the way, have you been there?
Multiple times. The people in Lockerbie are just wonderful people.
Yeah.
In fact, the priest whose house didn't burn down in Sherwood Crescent married my daughter and baptized my grandson.
Oh, man. So this has bonded all of you in this community of pain, of grief. And I'm wondering, not to dishonor your son, all the beautiful lives lost, but as you're well aware, you know, Lockerbie didn't used to have to be explained to people, and now it does. There's generations who weren't even born then. Your son, I think, would be in his 50s.
Would be 54.
Yeah. Your thoughts on that? So much time.
Well, it was brutal, still brutal, but we've been fighting through it and working at keeping ourselves alive and trying to find out what the real truth of all this is. And Massoud has apparently confessed to doing this, so having him in this country could be a good way to get all the details out of what happened and why it happened and who ordered it.
Right. Well, and there was talk at the time that the then leader of Libya, Muammar Gaddafi, ordered the bombing. He says he didn't. He turned over some of these officers. But this suspect, as you said, will do what for you? Because we've heard Lockerbie parents say there's never closure. But you said, you know, you're working to stay alive for decades now. What do you hope this helps you with?
Well, there's been some static about maybe Libya didn't do it and the Megrahi was unjustly convicted and that kind of nonsense. And it would be really nice to get that all swept away by having Massoud confess to what happened and explain all the details and who was involved.
Yeah.
It would be very comforting to know we know all about it.
Yeah.
And it's just unfortunate that the number of people who have passed in the last couple of years has just been incredible.
Yeah.
In fact, you all spoke to Janine Boulanger this morning.
Yeah.
And Ronnie, her husband, just died a couple months ago.
What do you want people to know about your son, Rick, so full of promise?
Rick was a writer. He journaled from the time he was a junior in high school all the way up till December 20th, 1988. Much of what he left his writings are an inspiration to a lot of young people today, which is wonderful. But it would be really great if he had been able to keep writing.
Yeah.
Most of what he wrote is at the, in the archives at Syracuse University. And every year, the 35 Syracuse students receive scholarships to represent the 35 people, students who were killed on the plane. And they get to read through all that stuff. And a lot of them are inspired by it. People who died 35 years before they were born are still, the kids are still being inspired by it. It's comforting.
Well, I hope you get the comfort you seek also from the upcoming trial in Washington. Robert Minetti, father of Pan Am Flight 103 victim Richard Minetti, Rick. Robert, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up.
With peace and hope for all mankind.
50 years after Apollo 17, are we ready to go back to the moon? That's after the break.
Splashdown. From Tranquility Base to Taurus Littro to the tranquil waters of the Pacific, the latest chapter of NASA's journey to the moon comes to a close. Orion, back on Earth.
That was NASA yesterday announcing the return of the Orion capsule to Earth. Orion is part of the Artemis 1 mission, the first of a series of missions that will eventually put a person back on the moon. It's now been 50 years since Apollo 17, the last time someone walked on the moon. Here and Now's Gabe Bullard visited the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. to find out how folks feel about going back.
If you are interested in moon missions, there's no better place to be, at least on this planet, than here.
We start the exhibit with some toys that talk about the ways that people used to play with the idea of going back to the moon, literally, as toys and playthings.
Margaret Weidekamp, the chair of the Space History Department at the museum, is showing me around the exhibit Destination Moon. From toys and comic book science fiction, visitors move into reality, passing spacesuits and rovers before ending up at the last boots to ever touch the moon.
This pair, you can see, they're rather big and bulky. They have the boot print on the bottom that forms that iconic boot print on the moon. And you can see that these are gray and dirty, and that's lunar dust.
Astronaut Eugene Cernan was wearing these boots when he took the last small steps into the lunar lander to head home.
We leave as we came, and God willing, as we shall return. With peace and hope for all mankind.
But they didn't return to the moon. Public support for moon missions fell because of concerns over cost and foreign and domestic issues the U.S. was facing, says Margaret Weidekamp.
One of the things that I don't think people realize is that public support for Apollo, for human spaceflight, has always been a little lower than we think in perhaps popular imagination, and especially if you ask about how much it costs. People tend to think it costs a lot more than it does.
So NASA changed focus to space stations and the space shuttle. But the moon is back on the agenda. Weidekamp, who just published a book about public interest in space, says that interest has always waxed and waned, but she believes space can still inspire us. And there are signs we're in a space craze now, with Artemis launching, NASA's plans to send the first woman and the first astronaut of color to the moon, rocket launches from Blue Origin, Virgin Galactic, and SpaceX, and a few developments in a galaxy far away.
I think that Americans and worldwide enthusiasm about spaceflight often draws not only from real achievements, but also from the fiction that people are watching and enjoying. And I think we're looking at a kind of golden age of Star Trek and Star Wars and The Expanse and other kinds of creative visions of what it means to imagine going into space.
There were plenty of visitors at the museum in Star Wars shirts, and even someone with a Baby Yoda bag, a mirror of the space age comics and games at the start of the exhibit.
I won't give you a Star Trek reference, I promise.
Chris Healy is in from Connecticut. Growing up, he was inspired by the moon missions.
I think it sets a sort of a tone for the culture. You know, if we are challenging ourselves to do things that that, you know, 20 years ago, 100 years ago, were just completely incomprehensible, sort of like the Wright brothers, right?
Moon missions inspired Derek Chan, too, though for him, they were history.
Definitely into the moon landings and all the Apollo missions, watched all the movies, kind of what inspired me to become like an engineer.
And now he's watching the future.
I actually stayed up late to watch the Artemis launch and all that. So, very excited for when we actually do go back.
And as for who might go back, I asked 7-year-old Savannah Billy, who was visiting the museum from Houston with her family, if she was interested. Would you ever want to be an astronaut?
Yes.
What makes you want to be an astronaut?
Well, I really like solar system and planet, and I've always wanted to go to Saturn.
Why Saturn?
Because it has, like, it's so big, and it has, like rings around. It's so cool.
What do you think it's like being on the moon?
Fun. Like, you could just learn gymnastics in 1 second there, because you could do flips and handstands and all that stuff.
And while future astronauts are at the museum to get inspiration, Weidekamp says the engineers who send them to the moon visit the museum, too, to get a few lessons on how to make it happen again.
NASA comes and looks at heat shields, looks at lunar suits, looks at these artifacts, and is using them to draw that connection from the literature that they have about what was done to being able to see the actual thing, so that when they're building the next generation, they are taking full advantage of that artifact history, that material history of what's been done in the past.
With peace and hope for, I mean, for here and now, I'm Gabe Bullard.
Coming up next, it doesn't take a grandmaster to know there's something wrong in the world of professional chess. But we've got one anyway, who's here to take apart the cheating scandal rocking the world's brainiest sport. Stick around.
What is going on in chess? It's a quiet, dignified sport, all self-contained anxiety. But like a long, dormant volcano, when it blows, it's a doozy. And that's what happened this past September, when the world's number one chess player, Norwegian super grandmaster Magnus Carlsen, was playing the American rising star Hans Niemann. And Carlsen resigned after just one move.
This is his main move. D4, knight f6, c4. Yeah, definitely. And what? No.
What happened? What?
What happened?
Magnus Carlsen just resigned, got up and left, switched off his camera, and that's all we know right now.
What? That's commentators Peter Lecko and Tanya Sachdev, both chess grandmasters themselves. Since then, there have been insinuation, then charges of cheating, investigations, admissions of cheating, charges of cheating pulled back, and now there's also a $100 million defamation lawsuit. What on earth is going on here? Well, unlike a chessboard, it is not all black and white. Sorry. We're joined by Dylan Lowe McLean. He's the former chess columnist for the New York Times, himself a chess master. Dylan, have I oversold this story?
No, it's definitely bizarre. And it has the chess world to titter, as you rightly pointed out.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not the first time that there have been allegations of cheating in chess, but it's the first time it's been at this level of the game where you have the world chess champion leveling such a charge.
Well, and it's also at a time where this might not be, if you're just tuning into this, your grandfather's chess. I mean, since the pandemic and that wildly popular Netflix series, The Queen's Gambit, how big has chess gotten?
Well, it's exploded. Chess.com, which is the largest site on the internet where chess players play, has now 94 million or more than 94 million people signed up. More than 5 million people are playing regularly on the site. And there's more money. There's been an increase in the prize funds. There are actually millions of dollars in prizes awarded each year in these large tournaments. So yeah, it's actually a game where there's some serious cash.
Yeah. Well, so now you have the Norwegian super grandmaster Magnus Carlsen, who's, I believe, 32, charging the rising, trash-talking American star Hans Niemann, how old is he now? Is he 19?
He's 19, yes.
Charging him with cheating. Let's just first, before we go through that, you know, who are these guys? Start with 19-year-old Hans Niemann, very popular on the gaming streaming platform Twitch. Fans really like his, you know, they're profanity-laden tirades. Here's a taste.
How am I this good? Bow down! How the f*** did I see that?
Okay, and here's an interview shortly after he was accused of cheating.
I've never, ever in my life cheated in an over-the-board game, in an online tournament, and I'm saying my truth because I do not want any misrepresentation.
So a rebuttal there, but he said over-the-board game. That means when you're actually physically facing a player over a chessboard. He has admitted to cheating as a younger person online.
That's correct. And one of the things that happened is he admitted to a couple of instances of cheating when he was 12 and 16. After that interview, chess.com released a 72-page report in which they documented over 100 instances of him cheating online. It was larger and more extensive, even more recent than he admitted to in that interview. It seems that the information in the chess.com report probably is accurate, although it's not 100% certain. That's something where there's always a little bit of unknown there, because to prove cheating requires some difficulty, even in online.
Well, you know, I'm going to jump in because as a non-chess player, I was wondering, what did he do, pocket a queen or something? And now I find out from your reporting that, of course, people are using algorithms online. They're sometimes with two screens. They've got one screen going on the online game they're playing and another screen going, you know, through this engine, chess engine, telling them what possible moves they should make. But how do you do that when it's an over-the-board match? How do you cheat?
Well, that's a good question. In the past, what people have done is they've snuck smartphones which run applications which are much better even than the best player in the world. That means Carlsen. And they've used them in toilets, for example. There was a guy who was caught doing that in 2019. There have been other people caught doing the same thing. People have had information signaled to them through remote listening devices. There was an extraordinary circumstance where a coach of a national team was standing in different places in the tournament hall to signal one of the players what he should be doing, receiving information from a person who was offsite watching the games.
Wow.
It's complicated. But with chess, you don't necessarily need to have information every move to cheat. The thing about this is that at the top levels, if you know one or two places in the game, or you're told one or two places in the game where it's important to concentrate, or maybe you know to move this particular piece, that might be enough to swing the game and to win all your games or most your games. So the information you might need to have signaled might be like a buzzing device. Buzz once for knight, buzz twice for bishop. It's not quite known what they did, but there are different ways you could signal to people.
Well, it's also not quite known if they did it in this case, because we should say the chess.com report came out and it laid out cases where they felt that Neiman, the upstart American, had cheated. But then a lot of other people who study this very closely, there's professors and scholars of this, weighed in and said, well, wait a second, we went over every one of his moves for the last several years. These were human moves. So there's some question as to whether or not he did cheat. And there's also the question of whether or not Magnus Carlsen's relationship with chess.com plays into this. Let's talk about him. He is the five-time reigning world champion. Some say maybe the sport's greatest ever. He has a financial relationship with chess.com, correct?
Yes. I mean, chess.com is actually in the process of buying Play Magnus Group, which is his company that he started back in like 2013. So obviously, he has a financial stake in what happens, as does chess.com. Just to go back on the cheating thing, you are right about the fact that whatever Neiman may have been accused about doing online, which is at chess.com, is different from what he may or may not have done in person. You know, whether or not he ever cheated in person is open. And in fact, as you say, there have been reports, including by a man named Ken Regan, who is sort of the preeminent expert on this thing, who has found no evidence of him ever cheating in over the board, you know, that's face-to-face competition.
Let's further get to Magnus Carlsen. This is what he said shortly after the incident. He was kind of cryptic.
People can draw their own conclusion, and they certainly have, and I have to say, I'm very impressed by Neiman's play, and I think his mentor Maxime Dlugy must be doing a great job.
Well, that was maybe a backhanded compliment, because it was a reference to chess player Maxime Dlugy, who, yes, was a mentor for Neiman, but was also found to have cheated on two separate occasions. So Carlsen wields a lot of power. He has a lot of admirers. What happens here?
Well, I mean, the first part of this process, or the next step in this process, is that the International Chess Federation has created a study group or commission to look into this particular episode. They will be issuing a report very shortly, I think, on what they found or did not find in terms of the allegations of cheating. Beyond that, Niemann, through his lawyers, has filed a $100 million defamation suit, and presumably that has to take its course before there's any kind of resolution, although perhaps they might settle, who knows. Yeah. At any rate, there's some things that certainly need to be settled.
Yeah, and until they're settled, what happens to this game? And what happens to this game if it turns out that Niemann had cheated? I mean, we understand from your writing that, you know, people are suspicious of everybody because of this new world we live in.
What some of the top players like Fabiano Caruana have said is that what Carlsen did was to shine a spotlight on a problem in chess. I mean, cheating doesn't necessarily happen all the time. It doesn't necessarily happen. Where it happens is not always clear, but it does happen. And the problem, of course, for any game, and whether it's chess or bicycle racing, as with the Tour de France and Lance Armstrong, or baseball and steroids, perhaps not the best analogy, is that when you have cheating, when you have people who are doing things that are breaking the rules, you lose confidence in the game and it undermines the credibility of the game. And eventually, of course, that's bad for business. I mean, you know, who wants to sponsor a sport or a game where there might be many people cheating, or where the top players might be cheating? So, and this is something that the chess.com have pointed to. They understand that, you know, they need to root out cheating, just as actually the International Chess Federation understands it needs to root out cheating. It's an incredibly important problem, no matter how often it occurs, because it does undermine the credibility of the sport, the players, and ultimately damages the game.
Well, we're going to follow this with you. We'll have you come back as the story develops. That's chess master Dylan Loeb McLean, also former chess columnist for the New York Times. We'll link you to his writing about this. It's pretty incredible. Dylan, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Check out our website, hereandnow.org, for more stories. We've got a conversation with the director of The Human Trial, a documentary that follows patients and researchers pioneering a radical new stem cell treatment for type 1 diabetes.
People are so excited.
Yeah.
Because it is working. Do I think it's going to get, you know, quote, shots in arms in the next 5 years? No, because in phase three of trials, you have to scale it up. Will they have success and will they have that press conference I always wanted to film? Yes.
Today's stories were produced by Lynn Menegon, Gabe Bullard, and Thomas Danielian. Our editors today are Todd Munt, Gabe Bullard, and Eileen Bolinski. Technical direction from Max Liebman and Patrick O'Connor. Theme music by me, Max, and Mike Moschetto. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin, and the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.